There's a topic that I want to cover today. It's actually going to be part of a series of a few sermons. I'll say three, which usually means four or five, but I'll say three. I want to talk about a topic we talked about before, but it's been a little bit of time, and I realize when you think about this, it's a very important one to refresh and talk about, and I want to approach it from a little bit of a different way too over the next couple of series, because this topic is a fundamental one for us to understand a number of things, and the topic is around the two trees. And if you want a title for the sermon, this is called The Two Trees Redux, Part 1, Foundations. And there's a colon in there. I'll let you figure out what that is. But I want to talk about, let's start with the foundations of why we're talking about this. And why is it important to cover this? I remember years ago, growing up in the church, used to hear Mr. Armstrong would always say this. He says, you know, he would cover the two trees and say, you know, most of you people or half of you people don't understand this. And you sit there in the audience and you would go, yeah, I know. I keep hearing you say this. And he would bring it up a lot of times and he would keep talking and speaking about it. And you used to always think, yeah, what's the big deal? As time went on, you realize what the big deal is. Because what we know is that in life, deception is going to happen. Deception has happened. People have been pulled away. People have been picked off. People have been drawn away. And it takes place no matter in any body, church, time, period, or whenever. And we know that that will happen. We realize that that will happen. But what the two trees understands and helps us understand is how it will happen, is the way it works, how people get sucked in, the how of things. We know the what. A lot of times we only talk about the what. But the two trees explains the how. And that's what I want to go over today, the mechanics of why the two trees explains the how. There's some foundational principles to understand of the when we talk about the two trees. And we'll see that it's super important to understand this because I think we have some misconceptions of how things will unfold. A lot of times we think it's just a matter of we have a set of doctrines and we know these doctrines and we just hang on to those. But the two trees tells us something different. How people get picked off is not arguing, be able to perfectly argue a doctrine back and forth, but there's other things that swirl around it are the things that cause people to fall. And we have to think about this from our own perspective to proof ourselves from this. So by way of that, let's start into this. There are four scriptures that you can string together. Let me tell you what they are first, and then I'm going to go through each one of them. The first one is 1 John 2:16. The second one is Genesis 3, verse 6. The third one is Jude 11. And then the fourth is a section, which is Matthew 4, 1 through 11. Those are the four fundamental scriptures to understand the two trees. Because what they define is a formula that has been around from the start of all time with humanity, which is Genesis. It's discussed throughout the Bible in so many examples. And it is reiterated in the New Testament. And it is something that was part of all the way that Satan has operated through time. So this formula is the way that Satan has worked from the beginning. It's a pattern you need to understand. And that's what the two trees tells us. How he goes and picks people off is this pattern. Because it hasn't changed. We think, wow, we're all sophisticated. We have all, you know, a different society and everything today. But you know what? It's the exact same things he does as he did from the beginning when maybe they only had tents and fireplaces. You know, when we have big sports cars, or we wish we had big sports cars. You know, we have all these newfangled everything in the internet and all this kind of stuff, but you know, it's the exact same things. The exact same principles from the start to the finish. Those verses right there take us through it. So the first one, let me read, because the New Testament talks about this. The formula that he's used is made up of three pieces of it. This is what the two trees tells us. 1 John 2:16 says, "For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world." So the way of the world, the way that this world and the ruler of this world works is through these three things, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. It is not God's way, it says. It is the way of the world. It is the way that Satan works. And Genesis 3, 6 is the same formula, but different words. Genesis 3:6 says, when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that's one thing, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and the tree was desirable to make one wise, she took and ate the fruit and ate it. She also gave to her husband, and he ate. So what we see is those same three things, the lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, the pride of life, are reiterated in Genesis as well. So lust of the flesh, she saw it was good for food. Man, this thing is appealing to me. It looks good for food. Lust of the eyes, man, this is pleasant, desirable, looks so appealing to my eyeballs. And then the pride of life was the same as desirable to make them wise. Wow, we could be superior. We could be wise. We could be like gods, right? And you see that those three things are reiterated again. Now, Jude 11 adds to this. So we have Genesis, the way Satan talked in the beginning. We have the New Testament talking about how the world is. And then we have Jude 11 giving us examples of these three things. And Jude 11 says, woe to them, for they have gone the way of Cain. They have run greedily in the air of Balaam for profit, and they have perished in the rebellion of Korah. Do you realize that those three examples that are given in that single scripture are an example of each one of the things? So the lust of the flesh talks about Cain, and I'll come back to that because it's important to understand that. The lust of the eyes was Balaam. Balaam was all about cursing Israel, and he did it for money. So he, you know, had his eyes fixed on his money. And then what was Korah? What was the conversation of Korah? Korah wanted to be in charge, and he stood up against Moses, and, you know, it was the pride of life, desirable to be wise, desirable to be in charge. And that's what his rebellion was all about. So we see a consistency in the way that Satan started with Adam and Eve and how he got them to cave. Then we see this reiterated in the New Testament. Then we see examples of it in Jude 11. And guess what? Let's string together Matthew 4 as well, because guess what the temptation of Christ was? Those exact same three things. Like when you see this pattern and you start to see, it's important to see it because it's throughout. It's consistent. So when Christ was tempted, right, you remember what he said? He said he stuck the bread in front of him. You know, eat this. Christ was fasting. You know, he appealed to the lust of the flesh, like, oh man, you know, you don't have to fast. You don't have to rely on God's power and strength. Just crave into your, or give into your cravings. And Satan tempted him with that. And then the lust of the eyes. You know what he did? He brought him up and he showed him all the kingdoms of the world and said, man, look at all of this you could have. Look at all of this that you could have. And you could rule this. You know, he appealed to both the lust of his eyes, like saying, look how magnificent these kingdoms are, these buildings and these pyramids and this, and I can give you all of this. And so he was really appealing to the eyes. And then the pride of life part, too, he gave him an option to get out of his debt. You know, basically, if you bow down and worship me, I'll give you all this. You don't have to go through the death part. I'll let you reign right now. And it took quite a bit of humility to say, Christ to say, yeah, he deserved to be a king, but he had to go through a humiliating death. And he, you know, could have called legions of angels down and had the power to do all this, but he didn't crave into that line of thinking with Satan. Satan gave him a shortcut and said, hey, you can get out of this if you want. I'll give you all this right now. You don't have to go through that humiliating death. So we even see the exact same things that Satan did with Adam and Eve, he did with Christ, and he does with you and I. And guess what Christ did before he was tempted? He fasted, didn't he? He realized the power of what these things were. He realized how Satan works. He had seen it happen to everybody so many times that he gave us an example to fast in the face of this, because it's a very strong combination of things. A lot of times we think it'll be an argument around doctrine that's coming in through here that takes people off, but that's not what picks people off at all. That's not what picks people off. Now, these things are important to understand what they are. Lust of the eyes, again, if you think about what lust of the eyes is, pleasant to the eyes, Balaam with money, tempted with the kingdoms, it's all the things that you can have or covet or want. And I can tell you, you know, especially in America, you're going to get offered so many different things out there. In fact, I think when you see the end times and the beast power and all that that comes on the scene, it's going to be one that is appealing, not just a negative. You know, you can give people a stick and beat them, or you can give them a carrot. Satan wants to give carrots that will lead you away, right? I think when you see things come on the world scene at the end, there'll be a lot of money involved. There'll be a lot of wealth. How do I know this? And I can read it to you later, because at the end, when the whole system falls, called Babylon, it made everybody of the world rich, it says, and everybody was distraught and upset because they could no longer have and make the riches that they got, and they got very wealthy off of this thing. So it's an appealing carrot to draw people to, is what the system will come with. It's not just, I'm just going to beat you, but it's a pull you towards it, if you want to think about it, to bring you and to seduce you into it. And so lust of the eyes is something that we need to understand today, because we'll see that come on the scene tomorrow. I mean, what if you and your are next to your neighbor, and one day he shows up with a brand new car and a shiny boat and this, and you know, I'm keeping the Sabbath, and somehow you're dinged for that, and all the people around you start to get more wealthy or more, you know, things, and you're not. This is how it unfolds, and this is how he works on us. Lust of the flesh. That's an interesting one, because it's, you know, to Eve, it looked like good for food. And Cain, the example that we are given, was anger. That one doesn't seem to fit when you first think about it. Well, lust of, you know, lust of flesh looks good for food, but anger. But think about lust of the flesh as indulging the flesh. Anything of the flesh that you indulge, or indulging the emotions. We're emotional beings, and God gave them to us for a reason. But indulging the flesh, indulging the emotions in anything, could be food, could be drink, it could be, in Cain's case, anger is the example given. And I think that one's very revealing, because it's anything that has to do with our emotions, our fleshly ways, and just letting them go, just indulging in those things, not having any restraint, and everything goes. And you see this today. We only think of it in the terms of drinking or, you know, pornography, which all these things are part of that, or the things, vices of the world. But it's indulging. Think of having no restraint and indulging whatever you want, whether it be anger, whether it be, you know, any emotions that you have towards other, anything goes. And it's just free reign and no restraint. And then the pride of life, desirable to make one wise. We'll have a whole sermon on this one, because the pride of life is something that is an undercurrent way of thinking that is the way of Satan in the way he thinks. And this is what his downfall is. And a lot of times when we look at what people do, it's because there is an underlying pride that's there. There's an underlying thought of things. There is an underlying desire to become something. You know, I feel like my whole life I've been ignored, but now I have my chance to shine and I can be great, or I can be over people, or, you know, I can have a special knowledge. This comes the way of special knowledge. You know, it's titillating to hear something that's like, oh, wow, you know, I've got this thing that the rest of the people in the church don't actually know. They don't get it. But you know what? I'm pretty cluey and I can pick up on it. I'll wait for everybody to catch up. You know what that is? That's a pride of life thing. We think it's about the argument. It's not. It's about the pride underneath it. Who cares about the argument? If you're teachable, you'll be taught the right thing. You'll hear Christ's words. But what gets in the way is pride, because I want to be smarter, or I have something special that you don't have, or I figured something out you don't know. That's pride underneath it. And so when we talk about the pride of life, it can be on a small scale for thoughts, or it can be on a grand scale for running nations and, you know, being over people and all of those type of things. But pride is a huge thing that underlines a lot of these things. Korah had pride. What did he think? He thought, and he told Moses this, you know, you're not so smart. You're not such a great leader. I could do this better than you. And look at all these people around me who think that too, right? I've got proof points. You're deceiving yourself. And what is that talk? It has nothing to do with all the things he said. There's pride underneath it. And that's what the example of Korah is shown. He wanted the power and he wanted the pride, right? Or the pride took him. And that is a huge thing when we think about it. So I pause to explain these things, and I give you those four scriptures because it shows those three things. From the very start of the Bible, it shows it in the New Testament, it shows Christ's temptation, and it shows it examples of it. And there's more scriptures of this. It's not just those. In fact, I'll show you an interesting one in just a second. But let's turn back for a second to Ezekiel 28, why it's important to understand these things, this way of thinking. So again, these are the things that underlie what take people off and take people out. It's not the I'm arguing about this doctrine. It is either the pride or the something that's around and underneath it that takes the person out. So this is the how it happens. We know people go sometimes, but this is how they get picked off, and this is why it's important to understand. So Ezekiel 28 is the story of Satan. The first half is really talking about a human king and a type. And then you see in verse 14, we'll pick it up there. This is not a person. You were an anointed cherub who covers. I established you. So immediately he's talking to an archangel. We know there were some archangels that are cherubim, and they cover God's throne, and they do his bidding. You are on the holy mountain of God. You walk back and forth in the midst of the fiery stones. You are perfect in your ways from the day you were created till iniquity was found in you. So this is a being that's created beings. This is talking of Satan. And he was not created this way. He was created perfectly. He was created perfection. And he was right in front of God and right before the throne of God, right before a ruler that was perfect, right before a being who was righteous, right before someone who was fair, right before the most amazing sight you could see. So we need to understand what happened to him, this being, is then what he turns around and how he gets other people to do the same thing. He fell, even though he was in perfect circumstances. And this is important to understand because we can't be a victim of things. We can't put it somewhere else and blame somebody else. Because if you were around perfect people, and I know some of us here are perfect, I get that, but you know, some of us aren't. I'm not. But you know, if you're around imperfect people, I jest. And you know, you can blame it always on something that somebody did, right? But what this says is that we have a scenario here where you were around perfection and around the best possible environment you could be, and these things still happen because that happened internally to this being. No matter even if you're everybody around you is doing great, it still can happen. So verse 14, he was there on God's throne. In 15, it says you were perfect in your ways till sin was found in you. 16, what is one of the things that was found in him? By the abundance of your trading, you became filled with violence within and you sinned. So there's two things here, trading. Right? Trading. It means exactly what it means. If you want to think about Wall Street and trading stocks and trading in goods and trading things back and forth, you start to get a focus on amassing and building and wanting money and trading things back and forth to become more powerful, more wealthy. And it said you became filled with violence within. So here's that pull, the desires of giving into, in this case it's a spirit being, but the same concept of the pulls of the flesh, or the idea of the lust of the flesh. Lust of the eyes and trading, dealing with money. That's one of the things in amassing that started him off down the wrong path. And he became fixated on that. And then he gave into his desires, the lust of the flesh. He was filled with violence. There we go. It's the same pulls, and he did not check them. God says, therefore I cast you out as a profane thing out of the mountain of God and destroyed you, O covering cherub, from the midst of the fiery thrones. 17, your heart was what? Lifted up. So have we found three things? Exactly the three things. Exactly the exact three things, again, is what happened to this being at the throne of God. He was lifted up because of his beauty. Oh man, I am the best looking cherub around here. And God told him that. You were perfect. You were amazing. I made you that way. But he got pride. He got lifted up. And your wisdom, you corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. And so he cast him to the ground. I laid you before kings that they might gaze at you. You defiled your sanctuaries by the multitude of your iniquities, by the iniquity of your trading. Therefore I brought fire from your midst and it devoured you. So very interesting to think about this. Is that this is how the being Satan started. These are the exact same things, three things that crept into his character that caused him to sin, that caused him to be so lifted up that what did he do? He thought he should be equal with God. You have to be thinking pretty big of yourself to get to that place when you know you've been created by this being who's a perfect being. You have to be so lifted up with who you are. And this is the underlying thing that happened with Satan, is this is part of it. But note the other two, trading. And if you want to find any characteristics of the system that Satan builds, it's going to be one that is to amass wealth, to have a focus on that, to drive, to be more powerful with it, to have more money, more things, more. And you see the world systems are all built around that. We see Babylon, probably don't have time to read it today, Babylon's system is built around wealth and trading. It's exactly what it says. You trade with the merchants of the earth. In fact, how about I just read that now? Let's just turn back there. I think I had this all the way at the end of the sermon. Go to Revelation 18. We'll just read it very quickly. Revelation 18 talks about the city of Babylon, or the system of Babylon. Right? There's a system, a spiritual system, in a way that this city is. It says, Revelation 18, verse 9, it says, "The kings of the earth who committed fornication and lived luxuriously with her will weep and they'll lament for her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance for fear of her torment, saying, 'Alas, alas, the great city Babylon, the mighty city, for in 1 hour your judgments come.'" Verse 11, "And the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, for no one buys their merchandise anymore, merchandise of gold and silver and precious stones and pearls and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet, of every kind of citron wood and every kind of object of ivory, every kind of object of most precious wood, bronze, iron, marble, cinnamon, incense, fragrance, oil, frankincense, wine and oil, fine flour, wheat, cattle, sheep, horses, chariots, and the bodies and souls of men." So what are we trading here? We're trading everything here, right? We are trading mainly things that are riches. We are mainly trading things that you lust after with your eyes, and you want the finest and the most and the biggest. And anybody who's part of this system gets wealthy. So think about that. What if the end time isn't coming, where it's just everything's destitute? I think the end time is going to come and try to pull you to it. The Babylon system will be alive and well, try to pull you that way. And verse 15, it says, "The merchants of these things who became rich by her will stand at a distance for fear of torment and weeping and saying, 'Oh, you know, it's crashed. All these riches came to nothing. Every shipmaster, all who traveled by ship, sailors, as many as trade on the sea, stood at a distance, and they cried when they saw the smoke of her.'" Right? And down in verse 19, it says, "Alas, alas, that great city in which all who had ships on the sea became rich by her wealth. For 1 hour she's made desolate." So you see this. This is the embodiment of how Satan works. This is the embodiment of what Babylon's system will be, is to appeal to you that way. That's why it's important to understand this. It's going to pull you. It's not just smacking you over the head. It's going to draw you to it. This is how it works. So let's go back. So we talked about those same three things are what took Satan out, corrupted him. The exact same things the way he started. He then took that and went to Adam and Eve, the first humans. And let's turn back there. Go to Genesis 3. Because let's see a little bit of the progression of this story of how it worked. And let's ask and answer a couple questions here. Progression of how this story works. Genesis 3, and starting in verse 4. "The serpent said to the woman, 'You shall not surely die. For God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil.'" Very interesting phrase that's there. We'll come back to that. "Because your eyes will be opened, and you'll be like God, knowing good and evil." That's kind of a slight mistranslation, or slightly not worded exactly great. You will be like God in the sense that what you're doing is you're deciding what's good and evil. You stop listening to the God who says, "Hey, you'll die if you do these," and you then turn into yourself, taking the role of God and deciding what is good and evil. You're deciding. So do we see this? Don't tell me what to do. Don't tell me what to do at all. I know, and this is good. All that matters is that, you know, I could be hitting somebody, hurting somebody. I could be over drinking. But all we need to do is to show love. Just show love. That's the biggest thing, right? Aren't you Christian? Isn't love the biggest thing? And so what we get is this. I get to decide what's good and evil. I get to decide what kind of relationships I am. I get to decide that I can be a gender, one of 37 different genders today. I can decide what is the right and wrong thing here. And that's what it means. You're putting yourself in the place of a God to decide what's right and wrong. Right? And so what we see is in verse 6, so when the woman saw the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and the tree desirable to make one wise, those three things, she took of its fruit and she ate, and she gave to her husband. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves coverings. And they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden on a cool day, and Adam and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord among the trees of the garden. Then the Lord God called Adam, and he said, "Where are you?" So he said, "Well, I've heard your voice in the garden. I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself." And he said, "Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree of which I commanded that you should not eat?" So there's a lot here to unpack, because the way that this unfolds and what the effect it was on Adam and Eve is pretty significant. Pretty significant. First off, let's ask the question, was this a literal tree? Was it a literal tree where you walk up and you take the fruit and you bite it and bingo, it all happens? I don't know. Because every single other example of how this is in the Bible is this is a way of life. And I'll show you. This is a choice. These are things that you do. You eat the fruit of a way of life. Am I eating of the fruit of God's way? Yes, there's a point of baptism, but do you have to eat of the fruit of God's way? Do I have to show love my whole life? Do I have to? And if we think about this, the way it happens with every single other example in the Bible is it's a way that I start to choose. I start to eat of the way. I start to do those things of the way. Hey, the fruit's presented to me. I am all about, drugs. I'm all about the indulging the flesh. I'm all about, and so I start to eat of that way, the fruit of that tree. If you want to think about it, you and I would eat of the same way. And I think we look at this, it's put in these terms for us for a reason too, but they had to start eating of it. Of course, there's a moment where they decided, which would be the equivalent of plucking a tree, but they kept doing the things of this way. Because otherwise, it's just a magical thing, isn't it? Hey, I just picked it. Whoa, all of a sudden it's this. It's going down this path and eating of the fruit of this way, of this tree, turns you into where they ended up. And where did they end up? They ended up into a place where a couple of things happened here. Their entire demeanor changed. Their entire approach to God changed. What were they doing with God? When they started down this path, they were hiding from him. And this is a key thing that will happen to a person who starts down this path, is all of the things of God will not look shiny. They will look stupid. They will look like, and you won't approach God because you know you've done something wrong, but you'll keep yourself over here in this place. And this is what happens when you start going down this path, is you hide from God. What does God do? What does the truth do? Truth is like a light that shines on the inside of us and exposes all of the bad things. You don't want to approach that light anymore. You stop approaching that light and you start hiding, and they hid. They hid from God. They're afraid. Oh no, we're going to get punished. We're this. And so you have to think of this as, I'm sure there's a moment where they chose, but this is a way of life that they chose. They started to do these things. They started to practice these ways. They started to eat of the fruit. It started to become who they were. And the more they did it, the more they hid. The more they hid from God. And they also, their eyes were opened. There's a certain sophistication that comes with this way. Your eyes are open. All of a sudden, I'm like, wow, your innocence is lost. Your trust in God is lost. Your hardness happens to you. Their eyes are opened in what they could be and the potential. There's an appeal to this side of the world. And don't kid yourself. The world's going to offer you this. The world will offer you this. You came from humble background and you could actually be a lot more sophisticated. I don't know if you ever talked to people who are fully immersed in this way. The superiority of how they think and who they think they are and what they know and how they talk about it and what they indulge themselves into and say it's no big deal and you can't handle it and just why are you so afraid of everything and blah, 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 blah. This is your eyes being opened. You become a different person. And another phrase that they became like, which is an interesting one here, is it says, how did you know you were naked? How did you know you're naked? And the way that Mr. Armstrong has interpreted this is to say that everything about this way becomes hyper-sexualized. Everything becomes way over-sexualized. And it's all about, you know, they knew they were naked and saw each other in a wrong sense, in a lustful sense. And so you cover up and because everybody is lusting after everybody, if you want to think of it like that, hyper-sexualized experience. And so the way that this path takes a person is exactly where Adam and Eve ended up. And when you start eating of the fruit of this tree, it takes you down that path. You stop reaching out to God. You start hiding more. Things are all about indulgence and hypersexualized and, you know, scared of God. And you become more sophisticated. Have you ever seen somebody go down this path? Have you gone down this path? Can you come back from it? Yes. Can you? If you repent, people who go down this path, you can come back from it. But if you don't see that you're pulled down this path and where you end up, this is what traps people, keeps them there. And it says in the New Testament, you get hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. There's a hardening that happens, a sophistication. Our eyes are open. I'm my own person. I'm my own being. And that stuff you think is very simple and seems very stupid. So if you think about the path that they went down, this is where they ended up. This is how Adam and Eve, that wasn't just the one-time moment is what I'm saying. It's the whole being in eating of the fruit over a period of time, they became that way. They made a decision, yes, but they ate of the fruit of that way. The same thing, progression happens to you and I if we eat of the fruit of that way. So it's worth to pull those things out of there because this is the, what's being contrasted by the two trees are two ways of life, right? God's way, he says, look, lest they also get, you know, immortality, I'm going to cut that off right now. And they've chosen this way of life, this path of life over here. So the two trees represent those two different contrasting ways, and this is a way of life that happens. We see the effects of what happened. Now, take this whole progression in a people, in a body, in a society, or, you know, a thing, and where does it end up? What does this end up as? Let me ask you this. What was the problem that God had with Sodom and Gomorrah? I think we have a quick answer, right? We say homosexuality, right? That's not what God says he had a problem. He had a problem with that, sorry, with where it ended up there. Well, hear me correctly. I didn't say he doesn't have a problem with that, but that wasn't what he called out here. Guess what God called out about Sodom and Gomorrah? I'll give you one guess. I'll let you take a wild guess. It's three things, and I'll let you take one guess of what those three things are. Yeah, lust of the flesh. What else? Pride life. And the lust of the eyes are in there. So then they're phrased differently because it's cruel to the poor was one of them, right? What you just said. So turn over to Ezekiel 16. Ezekiel 16. God specifically says, you know what? Here is where this city, where it got to. And here is the problem I have with it. And here's what they did. And guess what they did? Ezekiel 16, verse 48. It says, as I live, says the Lord God, neither your sister Sodom nor her daughters have done as you and your daughters have done. Look, this was the iniquity of your sister Sodom. She and her daughter had pride. There you go. There's one. Fullness of food. Okay? Indulged completely. Food and drink and whatever else. And that's how it's phrased, fullness of food. And abundance of idleness. Right? Think of that as whatever I see I want to do. I crave, you know what? Just, I don't want to work. I'm just going to sit here and I'm going to do all the things that I want. I see this, I want that. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor needy. So that, to strengthen the hand of the poor needy would have to be where you are actually willing to give up money of yourself and time, right? So the mentality that they were in is that they were all about idleness themselves and craving and doing whatever they wanted and craved, and they wouldn't strengthen the hand of the poor and the needy, those who needed it. They turned their eye away from that, right? So what you said is exactly the flip side of, you know, being that way and only heaping up wealth and things for yourself. These are, in verse 50 says, and they were haughty And they committed abomination before me, therefore I took them away as I saw fit. So what's interesting in the Old Testament here is that God is declaring what he saw as the problem with the society of Sodom. So God did not reactively kill them for one of the things they ended up doing and being, which was the depravity of their lust, to where they went after strange flesh, as the New Testament says, and they were, but their mentality of completely giving themselves over to this entire way of life, and the lust and the idleness and the depravity of the sexual, the whole package of these three things together is why God destroyed them. They were so far steeped into this that they couldn't come back from it. Think of it that. It wasn't just the one thing that the example that we see there was about. Do you follow that? That was a result of going way down the depravity path of where they were as a society. But it was those three things. And God says, I took them away, right? So you can see that those exact same three things, again, are what are called out. So this defines a way of life, right? It defines the choices and continuing to eat of the fruit till you get hardened, till you get to where Adam and Eve is, you're hidden from God, till you get to a depravity place. That's where it ends up eventually. That's why it's important to understand, am I actually starting down the path at all? Am I dabbling with the path? Am I eyes turning to this path or not? And because this is where it ends up and leads, if you don't realize you're even getting pulled away by it, this is where it ends up leaving. And it says they give themselves over to sexual immorality. It says that in the New Testament. That was one of the things that happened there. So we find that Sodom and Gomorrah were labeled for these three things, this way of life. And it's a perfect example of where society ends up when they follow it to the nth degree, that makes sense. And you see us going that way as a society. Therefore, it says, do not learn her ways. What are her ways? These are the ways. These three things are the ways. So it's important for us to check ourselves and to know and to realize that they're there. Now, let's see. Let's turn over to Proverbs 7. Proverbs 7. It's another important characteristic of this way to understand. It's not an intellectual argument. It is an emotional appeal. It's an emotional appeal. Proverbs 7, verse 1. My son, keep my words and treasure my commandments with you. Keep my commandments and live. And the law is the apple of your eye. Bind them on your fingers, write them on the tablet of your heart. Say to wisdom, you are my sister, and call understanding your nearest kin, that they may keep you from the immoral woman, from the seductress who flatters with her words. So we read this, and this is a literal thing, obviously, warning to young men. But you know what a moral woman is in the Bible, or harlot, or all those things as well? That's a system, or a religious system, or a way of thinking that's described what it will happen in the end times, but it's also Satan's way is described this way. And what it's telling us here is something important. What's important? It's described as a harlot, which is, and you will see this, it's a way of seduction. This is not an intellectual argument. It is a way of seduction to seduce you to it. Let's read verse 6. So, yeah, this is admonition to a young man, and if you're or old man or any man or woman, for the literal physical. But think about this in spiritual. Why do we think about the spiritual context? You know why? Because this is actually talking spiritually. I'll show you at the end. Verse 6, it says, I looked at the window of my house, and I looked through my lattice, and I saw among the simple, I perceived among the youths, a young man devoid of understanding, passing along the street near her corner, and he took the path to her house. Okay, so he's deliberately walking by her house. Think of it like that. Okay? In the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark, dark night. So, I happen to be wandering by what I know is over here in the dark times. Okay, think of this first. It accidentally happened. And there a woman met him with the attire of a harlot and a crafty heart. She was loud and rebellious. That's another characteristic. Christ was silent as a lamb to the slaughter. She's loud, rebellious, and her feet would not stay at home. And at times she was outside and times in the open square, lurking at every corner. So she caught him and kissed him. With an impudent face, she said to him, I have peace. Impudent, like, oh, look at you. I found you. I have peace offerings with me. Today I paid my vow, so I came out to meet you, diligently to seek your face. This way of life is going to find you. It's going to come after you. And it's going to flatter you. And it's going to try to seduce you. This chapter tells you this. And I have found you in 16. I've spread my bed with tapestry, colored coverings of an Egyptian linen. I perfume my bed with myrrh, aloe, and cinnamon. Come, let us take our fill of love into the morning. Let us delight ourselves with love. 19. Okay, read this. Seriously. Tell me this is not a spiritual chapter or a spiritual concept. For my husband's not at home. He's gone on a long journey. He's taken a bag of money with him, and he will come home on an appointed day. What does that sound like? That sounds like, you know, the king, the husband, the Christ. There is a man who's your, you know, we're the bride, groom. There's a husband, and he's gone away. And he's going to come back on an appointed day. Okay? That is a spiritual return of Christ. And this is what the Bible says. Hey, you know, watch yourselves, because I will come back on some appointed day. And 21, with her enticing speech, she caused him to yield. With her flattering lips, she seduced him. Immediately he went after her as an ox goes to the slaughter, or as a fool to the corrections of the stocks, till an arrow struck his liver, and as a bird hastens to the snare, he did not know what it would cost his life. Life. Terms of life here are spiritual terms of life. This will cost you your spiritual life, is what it's saying. Now, therefore, listen to me, my children. Pay attention to the words of my mouth. Do not let your heart turn aside to her ways. Do not stray into her paths. What did the man do? I'm just walking home, aren't I? He knew where she was, right? It's dark, and I'm just kind of going to wander over this way. And it says, 26, she's cast down many, wounded. You don't get out of this unscathed. It's a wounding thing. And all who were slain. So she can wound people. You think you're strong. You think you can walk by. You think you can dabble with. You're going to get wounded by this. And all who were slain were strong men. Her house is the way to hell, descending to the chambers of death. That's talking about spiritual life. Is it not? And guess who are the ones that get slain by this way? Are those who are strong even. Why did Christ fast in the face of this? Do you think Christ is strong? Absolutely the strongest person who was in the flesh to have ever lived, and yet he fasted in the face of this. It's saying, don't let your heart even turn aside to it. Don't dabble this. Don't wander by the house. Don't. You're going to get wounded if you're going to get cast down, and you're going to get slain even if you think you're strong. This is the way that those things work on us. Satan's way is a way of seduction, literally and figuratively, and you can see the flattering in the speech and the appealing. And look, there's no problem. Or, you know, he's gone away, and he's not coming back for a long time, and come on, and it cost him his life. Cost him his life. And there's some good advice. Don't let your heart turn aside. Don't stray into her paths. You know these things. You know where she is. Don't put your heart to it. So it's very important to understand, and this is the how it happens. We always think it's an intellectual argument. So was it intellectual with Eve? At first it was, right? What did she do? You know, God says, or Satan came and tempted her, tried to flatter her and seduce her. What did she reply back with? She replied back with God's words to start with, didn't you? God said, we shall not eat of the tree. It's like saying, hey, the Bible says. What made her cave in? What did it say made her cave? Oh, she looked at it. This is appealing to the eyes and the lust of the flesh and could make me wise. And she went for it. That made her cave. That's what Eve caved in. The seduction pulled her in. It got her. And it'll get every single one of us if we don't even know it's there. This is what I'm saying. Why do we cover this topic? It's very important. I know the audience has shifted since the last time I've talked about this. There's a lot of people who have gone and come. And so I thought it's a good time to bring it back up. But it's very important for us to keep this in our thinking, because this is how it will happen to people. The how. It's not just an intellectual thing. It's a seduction thing. and a way of life and flattering and something that you want, and it's titillating, exciting, and oh, it's all these things. I could be more sophisticated, wise. I could have all it. It'll pull you towards it. It'll seduce you into it. That's how it works. That's how it works. Sodom and Gomorrah went that way, and they fully realized how it was, and God says they are irreparable right now, and they destroyed them. That's the ultimate of it. So the way is going to seek you out. And that's how Eve's heart got turned. That's how her heart got turned away. Let's finish with one other, big thought here. So if that's the way of Satan, how it works, it's important for us to be aware of this. And what I want to talk about in the series is to get into some of the nuances of solving problems with the two trees. How do we address modern day issues in thinking, exposing them, and or how do you think we have it in our brains? Because a lot of times this is one where we go, yeah, we're not Sodom and Gomorrah, and you point your finger outside and the world's evil. It's important for us, like I said, he's already got most of the world and he wants to pick you off. So it's important for us to understand how he's going to wedge in with these three things to you and I, and how you proof yourself from these things. You know what's interesting is, what are the series of points that God outlines that would be the opposite of this way? Can you think of a series of points that would be the exact opposite of this way? These three things. God has more points than three. He's got 10, in fact. So the 10 commandments, if you actually break them down and section them off, are exact antidotes and the opposite of those three things. So if you look at Numbers 1 through 5, you shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make idols. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. And remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Honor your father and mother. What? What are you talking about? Those are all antidotes to the pride of life. So pride says, I am smart. The commandments say, you shall have no other gods, including yourself, before me. You worship me. You put your thoughts on me. Don't make idols out of the stuff you have. Don't take, have reverence. Don't be loud and rebellious and obnoxious. Don't think you're all this. Have respect for God. Don't take his name in vain in any single way. Think about reverence. And also, you're so important and you need 7 days to do your own way and your own thing and you don't need the Sabbath. God says, no, you stop. You put yourself aside and you learn my ways. And what does it take to honor your father and mother? So many times you have to swallow your pride. When you think about all the things that this is talking about, it's the exact opposite of behaviors as to what pride is. So 1 through 6 cover the antidotes of pride, if you think about it, and your focus is on God and worshiping and reverence to your parents, and taking time away from you being so important to making God important. Think about all those things. All of that action is the opposite of having pride yourself. So it's important for us to, you may not feel like keeping the Sabbath, but keep it. You know, you may not feel like honoring your mother and father sometimes, but do it. These are the things that are the opposite of pride. God's ways are the opposite of these ways. The other ones, in the end, you can probably pick these apart. You can think about it. They overlap with each other, but the last 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, you should not murder, commit adultery, steal, bear false witness, covet. Those are all mixed together, but they all of them have to do with lust of the flesh, if you think about it, right? Coveting and adultery and things like that. But then there's the lust of the eyes. Like, hey, I'm looking at my neighbor's, you know, car and wife and everything else. I'm coveting that. Bear false witness is, you know, coveting, taking someone down. You know, there's a whole bunch of things. Committing adultery, murder, these are pulling of the flesh. All of those are the exact opposites of lust of the eyes and lust of the flesh. So we have three ways that Satan operates, and we have 10 principles that God gives. At first you think, those are really rudimentarily basic. But guess what? They're actually really, really deep. When you start to pull apart the 10 commandments and the intent of them and what they counter, it's not immediately obvious. But those three things, stack them next to the 10 commandments, and you can group those straight across and see. They're exact antidotes, the exact opposite. So when we think of the tree, the knowledge of good and evil, it's those three things. And seduction, When we think of God's way, it is those 10 things encapsulate the ways of it in principle. And it's about life. And it's about living. One of these ways wants to trap you and kill you. One of these ways wants you to want it and to live. The world flips those around and says, I don't like God's way. It's just too controlling. It wants to, takes away my freedoms, and I hate it. That's Satan's way, actually. It gets you stuck, seduced, stuck, and dead. That's where it goes. God says, I can't make you. You have to want to. And it's life. So the two trees are a fundamental thing for us to talk about. And I want to give you that this as a foundation for what some of the other pieces that we'll talk about as well. But it's important to get the formula from the start of the Bible, the middle, to the end, to the tempting of Satan, to Sodom and Gomorrah, to you and I, to what it will be in the end times, and understand how it happens and how we get seduced by it and how we get trapped and pulled in. And it's going to be so appealing and one of these things that you just will draw you in. We always think of it as a hugely bad thing. It's going to draw you in. It's so appealing that you want that, try to seduce and trick you into it, but then you die. You get destroyed. You get trapped. You get stuck. Whereas God gives us a way that breaks all of that off, gives us freedom forward looking, and it comes by a completely different method than those. Do we ever mix them together? Let's save that thought for another time as we talk about undoing some problems. So that's a starter. We'll cover a couple more as we go forward. So thanks for coming today, and catch you guys after.